Welcome to Warships Pod and part two of a very interesting discussion with Lee Pilgrim about all manner of things. We did experience some connection issues during the recording, so that does affect some of the quality, but it is still a fascinating listen. So, Lee, to get things rolling in the second part of our chat, do you think a new dreadnought moment could save the Royal Navy?
A bit like a latter-day Jackie Fisher, Admiral Fisher, the quite controversial but very strong-minded and brilliant Admiral who led the Royal Navy at the beginning of the 20th century. He decided he would get rid of the deadwood, and he decided, right, we've got to build these new dreadnoughts and we've got to get on with it, so we're going to switch to them and we'll go down to having one dreadnought and then another fleet of pre-dreadnought warships, and we'll be back to one, but there again we'll be one ahead of everybody else. So then was born a new generation of warships, the dreadnoughts, and Britain lost its lead in so-called battleships, which were obsolete, but it gained a lead of one in a warship that was revolutionary and set the pattern. So do we need really, I suppose what we need is a Jackie Fisher who maybe goes and we're going to get rid of Daring, but before you say we don't need that ship at all, actually the reason I want to do it is to have these SSKs,
yeah,
or to accelerate another program, you know.
So one thing Jackie Fisher did have that we don't have today is he had a Julian Corbett. He had someone that said, here is the strategy, here is the way that Britain fights, here is our strategic direction. Jackie, you're the ops guy, now go and get me the kit to meet my strategic need. So you had that strategy and you had that mission focus. You had the guy that was Julian Corbett, not a naval guy, a lawyer, an author, sort of writing strategy on the way that the Brits fight war. Jackie Fisher can then go, right, I know where the Navy fits in that. This is the equipment I need to be able to meet that strategic output. Here is the kit that I don't need. But because he had strategy there, it wasn't, now I'm getting rid of all of this because it's just easier. Nope, this is the direction of travel that we're going in. This is the way that the UK is looking to fight wars over the next 30 or 40 years. This is our modus operandi. So he could get rid of the legacy wooden ships. He could get rid of the legacy sail ships, even though the dreadnoughts were built with sail masts for a variety of reasons. But it gave Jackie Fisher that space to make those decisions. What we're looking for today is someone to write that strategic narrative, even if it's an update of Corbett, to say this is the way that Britain goes about, you know, doing its business. And then the departments that sit under it to say, right, this is how I can deliver capability to meet that strategic need. I think that's what we miss. So having a strong First Sea Lord or a strong Chief of General Staff or a strong Chief of Air Staff, they're going to go in and cut things or change things. They need to be able to use a strategic reason to be able to say, I'm getting rid of Daring because this is what the Navy needs to be doing to meet this strategic output. I think that's a gap that we've got at the moment. Maybe Corbett needs to be updated, or maybe we need someone, you know, that can narrate where the UK is in the world at the moment, the role that the UK wants to play, and the way that the UK is going to do it. Then the single services can go, right, I can see where I fit in now. These are the things I need to get rid of, but these are the things that I need. Treasury can then go, right, now that's aligned to strategy. I can understand why you're doing A, because you want B. Yep, we can fund that and we can measure that. There's a tangible way of measuring that now against strategic output. A ramble again.
No, apologies. No, it's not a ramble. No, it's interesting because we're going off a tangent. It's not set in stone where we might head. But I mean, I was just thinking when you were saying that about the fact that even Jackie Fisher had people fighting against getting rid of the the pre-dreadnoughts, like Admiral Beresford, people like that, who kind of hated him for being who he was and being a radical thinker. And then there would have been people, I'm sure, that did not like academics and profs and lawyers and writers and that, telling them how things should go. But they also had, in politics, people like Winston Churchill, and I'm sure others not quite as famous, who had that kind of vision that matched their vision, and they came together. And I don't know who in politics today would have the clarity to actually meet, you know, the First Sea Lord of today, for an example, Julian Corbett, reborn, and then see these two guys and think, yeah, they're right. This is the way we have to go. So I don't know if there's anybody in politics at all.
Well, you would hope, you know, that's what the National Security Advisor and his or her team are supposed to do. They're supposed to weigh up these. This is the, you know, this is the national security strategy for the United Kingdom. The MOD, Ministry of Defence, don't set strategy. They're an outcome-based organisation. Strategy is sent by the CAB office and number 10. This is the direction of travel that we're going in. The MOD come back to say, here are the tools that I can provide to meet the UK strategy, same as health, same as justice, same as all the other things. Here are our tools to help government go on its direction of travel. MOD isn't there to set strategy. It's there to meet strategic outcomes. It's there to meet strategic means with tools, people, processes, organisation, and all of that. And I think there is that sort of academic vacuum at the moment. That's why we get lots of RUSI chats. That's why we get lots of IISS chats of people coming and saying, I think we should be going this way. I think we should be going that way. No one's actually sort of saying, no, here is our strategy. It's written in stone. It's been documented. It's been approved. Now go and deliver the means. You know, the whole idea of the Strategic Defence Review was there to set a direction of travel. It's the CEO of an organisation that's saying, this is the direction I want to go in. And then the Defence Command Paper, which should follow, is the COO, the Chief Operating Officer's document that says, this is how we're going to do it. And then they go off and do it. Unfortunately, because it's the MOD, you get a Strategic Defence Review with bits of the Defence Command Paper in there. We need to put something in there so it makes it tangible to the public. We're going to buy up to 12 submarines. There you go. There's a news announcement I can put into the press to say, yeah, we're going to do X. That's buying a kit. Why is strategy thinking about the purchase of kit? Should have nothing to do with the purchase of kit at all. It should just say, that's my direction of travel. What people are waiting for now is that Defence Command Paper so they can start building their models on their desks. They can start building their model armies, their model navies, and their model air force. They can count their squadrons. They can count their frigates. They can count their destroyers, and they can count their tanks. They'll come back and say, we've got fewer tanks, destroyers, ships than we had yesterday, so this is bad, you know, and then that whole debate is going on. No one's actually asking the single services against the constraints that you've got, is this meeting the strategic need? Are you delivering against the strategic need? If you can demonstrate that, Treasury will be a lot happier because they'll say, yeah, there's a means, there's an outcome, and there's a way to do it. More importantly, like any business unit, business units have to make cuts to be efficient. So the Royal Navy is a business unit. The Royal Air Force is a business unit. The Army a business unit. They're delivering profit and loss accounts. These are the things, these are the redundancies we need to make. This is the old kit that we need to get rid of. Here is something that's sat alongside. If I'm a minister or a senior civil servant, I'm coming down to Portsmouth every couple of months and HMS Daring is still sat there. What are you doing with that this week? Why is it still there? What are you doing with it? Get rid of it. If you're not using it for anything, get rid of it, because the money can be spent better elsewhere. And I think people are afraid of that. I think people are afraid of, you know, and again, it goes back to the thing I was saying earlier about the MOD and Treasury. There's a fear that if you cut something, you don't get it back, because the Treasury will go, well, you've accepted the risk, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you've got a good argument, and the Treasury can say, yep, like, okay, that works, yeah, fine. You can do that, because I read a thing about Rule 60. So the MOD, 60% of the value of any whole life project should be invested back into the UK. It's a simple, tangible thing that you can show Treasury to say, I'm going to buy three more Type 31s, but I can demonstrate 60% of the value of the thing that I'm buying goes back into the UK. Treasury will go, perfect, because you're creating jobs, you're creating revenue, you're creating all the things that we need, and we get a ship at the end of it. You know, the debate is going on now. Do we need Type 32 or do we need three more Type 31s? Again, it's numbers. Against what outcome are you thinking you need these platforms for? How can you crew them? How can you man them? Hence the Type 91, Type 92 sloops and all the other things that are now being thought of.
So, the Type 31 frigate Type 91, 92, is that a destroyer? I can't keep up.
So these are the sloops. These are the... it's all to do with barrier. So the barrier in the North Atlantic.
The Atlantic bastion where...
Yeah, the bastion.
We're going to wait for the Russians to come to us.
And then almost as if,
and they're going to politely allow us to hunt them with these sloops rather than sit in their own bastion, invulnerable.
It's almost as if we're back to the 1980s again. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure the submarine fleet guys are very, very happy because it's like the old days all over again. Russian submarines coming down. So Tom Sharp and I discussed this about the carriers, the two carriers, you know, where is their primary role? Where does NATO want us? Does it want us going around the world, or would it like to see that carrier up in the Northeast Atlantic doing its job, freeing up a larger, I won't say a proper aircraft carrier with a full, but you know, the second fleet can then go off and do other things.
The Americans,
because we're now filling a gap. Yeah, they can. You know, we are doing our bit for NATO. The French are doing their bit for NATO. We are providing coverage in that area to allow NATO to go off and do other things. Doesn't stop us going off around the world on the Sunshine Tour, because that's always very, very nice. But it's the Royal Navy getting back to its bread and butter. What does NATO need out of us? What does the country need out of us? Well, it needs shipping lanes. Again, go back to Corbett. It's all about trade. It's all about shipping lanes. It's all about looking after our own backyard. You know, it basics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about. I mean, you said that about the submariners would be quite happy. I mean, I'm not taking that as a slur on the valiant submariners, but I think actually the old strategy being that you push forward, you know, with those special fit submarines in the Cold War into the Greenland Sea and the ice and into the Barents Sea, that to me, pushing forward like you're suggesting with the carriers, pushing forward, putting the Russians under pressure up there, which is what we did in the Cold War, and carriers were involved. British carriers as well were involved in that in the Cold War, is to me much better than some kind of passive Atlantic bastion. When the Russians don't need to come down through the Greenland Ice and UK gap, they've got missiles with a range to hit us from the Barents Sea. I mean, that's an old concept for them, you know, with their conventional missiles, not their nuclear missiles, their conventional missiles. So, I think a forward strategy, like you suggest, would be a very good idea. And I think all of the, you know, things that the Royal Navy has could fit into that sort of thing. But it seems to me that the reason, and I could be unfair here, that this Atlantic bastion was conjured up was because they have very few frigates, very few, if any, submarines, very few aircraft, maritime patrol aircraft. And so the magic bullet, and I'm not saying, again, that drones are not going to be very, very important. They are, as the decades pass, and they will become more and more capable. But it seems to me that the idea is that, yeah, instead of we'll have this bastion and we'll have all these drones patrolling around it, listening and finding things. But how are you going to queue in? They're going to queue in a ship that's got to get from A to B to kill that enemy submarine. If you're imagining the enemy submarines will come down through the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap and into our waters. Yep. You've got to have enough of them at the right point, whether it's hunter killer submarines or frigates, to immediately, or P-8, Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, to immediately be queued in or find them themselves and destroy the enemy straight away. There's no good just being a kind of passive thing where you go off on a wild goose chase. That sounds to me, going on a bit of a riff here, but that sounds to me very much like some of the strategy in World War One. Or pre-convoy, where they thought that the destroyer captains and the courageous young captains of warships didn't want to do something that was a little bit more not passive but a little bit less aggressive. So they haired off all around the ocean trying to find U-boats instead of letting the and again I'm kind of contradicting myself here, but they let the U-boats come to them. To attack the convoys, and then they knew where the U-boats were instead of hunting for them like a needle in a haystack, and they killed them. But bizarrely, I think the bastion is a little bit like, the pre-convoy thing. If you know the Russian submarines are going to be in their own bastion, not coming into your bastion up in the high north, why are you adopting a passive strategy instead of creating forces that can go into their bastion or on the periphery of their bastion and make them worried about it? And also that they could be destroyed, which of course was the forward strategy of the Cold War. So, I mean, I'm maybe getting tied up in knots there, but I think you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. So drones are not a panacea. So at the moment, UAVs, USVs, that's where the money's going. Drones will solve all of your problems. You're still going to need a human at the end of the day. So drones are there to aid the human, not replace the human. So platforms going up, Type 26s, 31s, whatever it will be, they will travel with drones. You know, within the airspace, they're looking at this now. You know, let's say we've got our Type 31 or whatever it is, but there are two sloops with it. So these are the things that deploy forward. So ever so slightly forward of the 36 or, but they're reporting back to the 26 or 31. They're reporting back to the people. Having these, the idea of that these 91s and 92s will just be randomly floating around. There was a thing in the news last week about a Chinese UAV display that was taken out with an EMP. You know,
I saw anything, it. Yep.
So technology, you know, if you build something that's shiny and technical, I'll build something more that's going to defeat the thing that you're building. At the end of the day, it comes down to people. People can only beat people. Technology will always beat technology. So we're going to have the vessels up there. If you can use UAVs, drones or whatever to help shape the enemy, to put them in a position where they are behaving in the way that you want them to behave, going down certain channels, that's great, because you can have your Type 26, your 31, or your submarine sat at the end of that channel. I'm sat there at the end waiting for you. Perfect. And the GIUK gap is ideal for that. And we were doing that in the 70s and 80s. That's where SOSUS came in and all the other things, you know, creating channels so we knew the routes that the Russians were coming down. So we could sit a Type 22 or a Type 23 there, or an Ox class or whatever it may be. So when that Russian submarine arrived in that box, we could see it and hear it and tell them, we can hear and see you. So it restricted the way that the Russians or the Soviet Navy of the time operated in those waters. All the grey shipping that's going on at the moment, all the grey and the black shipping, all comes out of the Barents Sea. It all comes out of that area. Russians, we know you're doing this. By the way, we can see you doing this. And we're collecting intelligence on this that we can then report back to the authorities, to Lloyd's or the insurers, whoever it needs to be, that tags the vessel to say when it arrives or wherever it's going, we know it's a grey vessel. Civilian authorities, that's military aid to the civilian power. There you go. We've identified this vessel. It's a grey vessel. Its AIS is off. We've done that. We've reported it. What's next? That gets your adversary changing their behaviour, because we're now pushing, you know, we're now right up at their front door. Sitting off the south coast of Iceland in a bastion, waiting there, going, you know, when you come into our den, we're going to have you. Well, that's fine. I'll work out a way to go around your den. I'll find a different way to get around, because you're not up in my face. You're not in my front door. Type 91s, 92s, I see them as partners. I don't see them as operating independently. This is human machine teaming. This is not sending drones. We are not trying to replace humans with drones. That's, you know, that's an easy way out to generate mass without actually generating capability. And for politicians of today to say it again, it's activity over achievement. Look, we're doing all of this thing. We've got all of these UAVs. Okay, the Chinese are working out how to defeat all the UAVs that we're taking so long to create. You know, the reason why UAVs are so prevalent at the moment is because everybody watches the war in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine is the way that it is because there is no control of the air. So what you're seeing now is you're seeing World War One. We've got soldiers training in the UK at the moment in trenches. So training areas are having trenches built again because of the way that combat is going on in Ukraine. And this is because there is no control of the air. With no control of the air, you've got no freedom of action or no freedom of movement. And that will be exactly the same in the you know, in the maritime space as well. That's why air power in the maritime space is so important. Having little drones or little sloops bobbling around the Ogin, sending stuff back, you know, how do you know if that platform has been captured? How do you know if that platform has been taken? You know, you need a human there. People process organization technology facilities. Technology is number four on the list. Number one is a person. You need a human to be able to go and make decisions about what to do next. Let's just say that sloop comes across a Russian vessel. It can't decide what it's going to do. We need a human to make that, you know, and I'll use an acronym, OODA, the Observe, Orientate, Decide, Act. We can make the decide process quicker, but it's the human that has to do the action. The human has to be there to act. And I've gone down a rabbit hole now as well.
No, it's fine. No, yeah, you're right on the OODA thing, because I was talking to an experienced SSN Captain Friend, you know, from not from serving at the moment, but, you know, not that long ago. And he made the same point when we were talking about drones, is that let's say you were out there in the North Atlantic and a potential Russian target comes down, and you've got everything in your submarine, you know, sonar operators, you can listen, passive, active, whatever, you've got weapons, you've got a human being in there. And so once you identified that, and provided you have the rules of engagement, you can then act to destroy, take out that target, that, let's say, Russian submarine immediately, or surface vessel, spy ship. But if you're just a drone, then you've, as you've just said, you detect it, then you have to try and find out what it is, then you identify what it is, then it has to somehow get a message back to a human who then decides to actually, as you just said, take action. So it's a fairly simple thing, isn't it, for people to understand.
So one of the reasons why Patriot is so popular with users is because it's automated. You can put it into auto mode, like a GIS or something like that, and the system then takes over and it does everything automatically. There is no human anymore in the loop. This works very, very well, but sometimes mistakes or errors happen. The Tornado GR4 that got shot down by Patriot in Gulf War II is an example of this. For the UK, we make sure we have a human in the loop. That, you know, there is a human at the end of the day, be it ASTA or whatever system it may be, to make that final decision. To have drones and sloops up in the Northeast Atlantic when faced with a Russian adversary, it still needs that. If I cut the signal, if I find a way to put an EM, to put a signal cloak over that platform, that platform's got no way of talking back to the actioner now to be able to do the thing that it's designed to do. It's got weapons on board. It's got sensors on board. It's identified the target. It's classified the target. It's got its weapons ready to go. But because it can't speak to the human to say, can I fire my stuff? It just sits there. Unless we change the law, which I don't think we're going to do anytime soon, our law will always state that somewhere in the chain, the kill chain, a person will make that final decision. When you're talking about killing other people, it needs to be a person that makes that decision, not a machine. I don't think the UK has quite reached the point yet where we're going to allow machines to make decisions on who lives and who dies. There will always be a human there to make that final decision. So great for recce, great for going out on patrols, great. But when it actually comes to kinetic effect, e.g., you know, putting metal onto meat, where's the person? From a UK point of view, from a legal standpoint, we don't allow machines to make kill chain decisions. There always has to be a human there. So yeah, relying on UAVs to do all of that, going to the point that was made earlier, that machine has to reach back to a human to say, are you authorizing me to do X? If I cut that link, if I find some way, you know, to deny you that link to that platform, platform's pointless. Just a bit of metal floating around in the ocean.
Yeah, people shouldn't forget that when the Ukrainians send their sea babies or whatever it is, their sea drones across to Novorossiysk or previously to Sevastopol in the Black Sea, there is a person, actually. They've got a camera. And so there is a person in the kill chain. It is not yet Skynet, you know, from the Terminator. You know, there are people in that kill chain. And so when people get really excited by that and say, this is the way all naval war is going to be, they forget also that the Black Sea is quite a restricted space, has always been very difficult to wage naval war in. And then when they look at the drone blitzes of Ukrainian cities, of course, we've had that before. That was V1s and V2s, you know. So that's not new either. It's just they're now Chinese or Iranian-made drones, you know.
And it's overwhelming through mass. And to use the, you know, let's look at the USVs in the Black Sea and others, sinking ships. This is not a change in naval warfare. This is just the Russian Navy being a bit crap.
Yes.
You know, this is, you know, just because USVs have managed to sink a Navy, okay, wasn't the best Navy to start with. The equipment wasn't the best. I would suggest that against a Pier 1 Navy, Royal Navy, US Navy, French Navy, the outcome will be subtly different. So people going down that route to say, look, USVs can now defeat navies. Well, look at your adversary. Look at the Navy that you're beating. You know, you can see it from the cameras on the USV when they're attacking the LSLs. All their lights are on. All their hatches are open. You know, they're sailing along at 6 knots. None of their sensors are up and running. They're all outside smoking. You know, this is not a ship that's in a war fighting role. You only have to look at the Falklands. When a ship locks itself down, you know that it's a completely different configuration to what you're seeing the Russians sort of floating around with at the moment. So for people to say drones and USVs, that's the panacea, that's the future, the days of big warships are over, I think they miss the point.
Yeah, and when you look at the big hits that the Russians have taken, the Moskva and the submarine, I was writing about it just the other day, actually.
Yeah.
The Rostov on Don, or Rostov na Donu, whatever you want to call it. They were actually destroyed by missiles, and they were caught. Like, the submarine was caught in dry dock twice, I believe, or alongside in Sevastopol. And the Moskva was just incompetence, establishing a pattern, not being vigilant. And then they distracted them, I believe, with drones, and then they did it with missiles. So it's not, the drones have inflicted losses, but it's not yet, you know, Skynet or whatever.
No, yeah.
And when it comes to drones, years ago for the magazine, when we did another guide to the Royal Navy, I think it was the 2008 one, I spoke to a senior Fleet Air Arm branch admiral who was talking about the F-35 as it was about to arrive. And he explained that the F-35 would be a nodal point for drones to operate alongside the F-35 at some stage, the F-35B. And so that, you know, and with this theory that you can send forward your drone, your attack drones into the real, especially if you're facing the Chinese, you could sit your F-35B at quite a distance and send the attack drones in, several of them in to do the, you know, the actual attacking. But it strikes me that's great. And maybe that's the way forward, you know, to force multiply with the Queen Elizabeth class. But of course, at the moment, the main problem is it's the current generation of weapons that the F-35B lacks. I mean, they can drop bombs, but I mean, what's your perspective on it being great that we've got carrier strike? And I think it was 19 F-35Bs aboard HMS Prince of Wales,
yep,
in Darwin yesterday or a few days ago. But, you know, strike jets, F-35Bs that can't actually stand off with missiles or use more sophisticated weaponry, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, again, they're not much good, are they?
No. So this will be a long ramble from me. So this is probably best that it's two episodes. So 1998, we go all the way back to 1998 in the Strategic Defence Review and the replacement of three smaller carriers with two fleet carriers, which was all part of a strategy. So go back to that thing, strategy again. So global Britain is going to go out into the world, and to do that, we're going to do that with two big fleet carriers. The blue part of the Royal Navy was chuffed to bits. We're 1978, all over again, Ark Royal is back. So they said, yep, two big carriers. First conversation is, what platform, what aircraft are we going to put on it? So F-35 was a joint strike fighter at the time, and there's three variants of it for those that don't know. There's the F-35A, which is used by air forces. So it's designed for combat. It's got good 9G turn rate, it's got good bomb bay, it's got good range. Then you've got the F-35B, which is the vertical takeoff, short takeoff, a landing platform, which is very good for the US Marine Corps, who require aircraft to provide support for them as they land on beaches and things like that. And then you've got the F-35C, which is the naval platform, the replacement for the F-14. So it's got good legs, it's got good wing area, and it's got big bays, so it can take big missiles and it can stay in the air for a long time. So they're the three aircraft that were presented. So we decided to go down the joint strike fighter route. If you look at it from a needs analysis point of view, the Royal Air Force want the F-35A because that will be a natural replacement for certain variants of Tornado, Jaguar and other platforms. The Royal Navy will want the F-35C because it replaces what they had with the Phantom and the F-14, something that could fly a long way from the aircraft carrier, set on carrier combat air patrol and then come back. Industry wanted the F-35B because the F-35B had the Rolls-Royce lift fan and all the other bits and bobs in it that replaced the Harrier. So a decision was made, which is neither right nor wrong, because a political decision is a political decision, that the Navy would get the F-35B. So the F-35B, against the role that it's designed for, is the least capable of the three aircraft. It's got the shortest radius, range is irrelevant. So people like to talk about the range of an aircraft. The range of an aircraft means it's just going in one direction. So if my aircraft's got a range of 800 miles, so what? So it still needs to come back. It's not a passenger airline that's traveling from air to airport. So it's all about that combat radius thing, the ability to go from the point of takeoff to go to the target, to deploy the weapons that you need to do and return. So radius becomes massively important. So we've decided to go down the B route. So that means the Navy have to do a lot of thinking. That means the Air Force are very, very disappointed because they're not getting an aircraft that they can use. It's not the thing that they can use to deliver the missions that they wish to deliver. Dropping interdiction strike missions, so traveling a long journey, dropping weapons and then being able to return. That's not what the F-35B has been designed for. So they've spent the last 25 years trying to lobby for the A model, to try and cut into the 138 Bs to get some A's. And we'd have seen that the last SDR, again, a strategic review that did defense command paper things, we're now going to get the F-35A. So the Air Force has finally got 12 of the 24 airplanes that they need. And I say 12 of the 24 because they need 24 because that's probably the mass that they need to sustain the pilot numbers, the capabilities that they want to deliver, and a variety of other things. So we picked the F-35B. That was then up for debate in 2010, 2012, where there was a big debate about we should go down the C route. So the MOD spent about £800 million having a massive chat with itself about going down the C route, only for the shipbuilders to say it's going to cost so much money to convert the aircraft carriers that we're already building to do CTOL, conventional takeoff and landing, and not STOL. Unless you give us the 2 billion odd quid and accept the delays, it's not going to happen. So we're now back with the B. So F-35B got a radius, a combat radius of about 350 miles. It's got no air-to-air support or air-to-air refueling support from the carrier. Why is that important? So if you look at charts, the F-35B has got about the same combat radius as an F-18. So people will say, see, there you go, it's roughly the same as that. F-18s have got F-18 F-4Gs, I can't remember which ones. When the aircraft takes off, they get tanked in the air. So they take off, they get tanked, they go off and do the thing that they need to do. And then on their return, those tankers are sat there again to tank them back up so they've got enough legs to land. If you don't have enough legs to land, then you've got to go to India and sit on the tarmac for 37 days, not to highlight that. So the Navy, I've got a platform now that against their original requirement doesn't quite fit the need. So they now have to bend the way that they do operations to fit the constraint that they've got. And I call for the Royal Navy and what they want to use the airplane for, let's go back to the 1970s all over again, the Buccaneers and the Phantoms. They had single type airplanes to do single type roles. A Phantom would fly 300 odd miles away from the carrier and sit there on combat air control. And again, it would sit 100 miles off that, providing limited airborne early warning. Buccaneers would then go with their bomb loads and deliver carnage and bombs at very, very low level to do all of that. Now we've got an aeroplane that we're trying to do both of those things with that do not have the legs of a Phantom and do not have the weapon systems of a Buccaneer. If we look at the Buccaneer, for example, the way that it got around stealth, because it's not stealthy, is it flew so close to the ground that, you know, the radars or anything couldn't see it. It was when you haven't got stealth, you design your platform to do the things that can beat the radar. The easiest way to beat the radar is to get as close to the ground as possible and fly. So all the pictures that you see of Buccaneers, you know, they're always pretty close to the ground to go and deliver the thing. But they've got long legs and they've got lots of fuel and they've got an internal bomb bay, which, you know, and they can deliver a lot of ordnance at great distance. Roland White wrote a great book about 809 Squadron in the 70s going down to Guatemala just to fly the flag. You know, that shows carrier air power at its best. But if you look at the way that carrier air power was deployed, specifically the Buccaneer, the Buccaneers took off. They were buddy-buddy fueled by a Buccaneer. They then flew off to do their mission. They flew back. They were buddy-buddy fueled by a Buccaneer and they landed. So you've got this F-35B, again, radius, combat radius of about 350 miles. So when you see the thing in beast mode with all of those bombs on board, what's the combat radius of a thing that's carrying 11,000 pounds worth of ordnance? I can guarantee you it's not going to be 350 miles. And when it's not 350 miles, are you going to put your £3.1 billion aircraft carrier that close to the enemy, you know, as to cause it undeniable risk? And that comes down to the point that you were making a minute ago. So I've talked about ASRAM, short-range air-to-air missile, AMRAM, medium-range air-to-air missile, and then it's got Paveway 4, an iron bomb with a laser seeker on the front, and it's got a bit of a GPS. So that means that the F-35B has got to get within about 8 to 10 miles of the target to be able to deliver its weapon system, to deliver its payload. Go back to that 350-mile radius again. That means my aircraft carrier now has to be within at least 350 miles of the target. So I'm now in the A2AD zone. We only have to look at the hypersonic missiles that the Chinese and others have got to say 350 miles isn't that far anymore. If we look at the US model, and they did a fantastic photo the other day of the air group that they've got. So it's part of the exercise that's going on down there. They've got E2D Hawkeye, which flies at least 300 miles away from the aircraft carrier and then puts its air picture up. It's got F-18Cs, F-18Fs, F-18Gs. It's got F-35Cs. It's got a whole plethora of capability to be able to deliver effect. The challenge that we've got with the F-35B is it's, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a compromised platform. The Navy is trying to make the best of something that it didn't originally want in the first place. So it's got to try and make the best. And that's where things like Loyal Wingman come in. So the Ark Royal project, which, you know, is the Navy trying to work out how to make the best of what it's got, it is a brilliant way of improvised adapting and overcoming. So Ark Royal, for those that don't know, Ark Royal is all about putting basically a 55,000 pound catapult onto the carrier to allow it to launch heavy UAVs. So F-35B, I think it's about 85,000 pounds and above. 55,000 pounds is about, you know, it's small enough to be able to fit in. What does that mean? It means that when my F-35B goes up, I've now got Loyal Wingman that can go with it. So my F-35B...
When you say Loyal Wingman, you mean the drone that you just...
The drones, yeah. So the drones. So in effect, and again, this is nothing new. In the 1970s and the 1980s, for air defense of the United Kingdom, we had Phantoms and Lightnings and other bits and bobs. But we had these things called Hawk T-Mark 1As. And the Mark 1As means that they were fitted with Sidewinder missiles. So the 1A bit was that they were wired for Sidewinders. So what used to happen is your Phantom would go up and it would take two Loyal Wingmen with it. So two Hawks, the manned Hawks, the two.
Right, yeah.
Yep, the Hawk T-Mark 1As. So you'd have a Phantom that goes up and it would partner, or it'd have two Hawk T-Mark 1As who would basically use the radar of the Phantom to direct itself onto targets, which is what Loyal Wingman is doing. So your F-35B goes forward, and then it's basically forward deploying those Loyal Wingmen to go forward to actually do the offensive counter-air piece. The other thing that you can also do with your Loyal Wingmen, so there's offensive counter-air, bombing the enemy or taking the fight to the enemy, and then there's defensive counter-air. One of the things that you can do with defensive counter-air around an aircraft carrier is you can define boxes, and you can put one of your drones in that box, and then you can set a rule to the enemy to say, if you fly inside that box, my drone will attack you, because that's the box. So I can set the rules of engagement exactly as we did in the Falkland Islands. Here's my 200-mile exclusion zone. If you come inside my exclusion zone, I'll attack you. What you can do now with your Loyal Wingmen is you can say, well, they're uncrewed. They can sit up there for a long time. So that DCA box, it can now sit, which frees up my F-35s with a human in it to go and do an offensive mission. Because remember, go back to what we were discussing earlier. When we're bombing things or people, kind of need a human in the loop to do that. If an enemy aircraft flies into my DCA box under the rules of engagement, my drone can take it out because I've set the rule. If you fly into my box, my drone will shoot you. So there's a nice simple rule.
In the 1990s, the mid-1990s, Britain sent its carrier groups, because I went out there a number of times, down to the Adriatic And of course, they found out that the Sea Harrier wasn't brilliant at dive bombing because they shot one down over Garajda. And I was actually on board Ark Royal when they brought the pilot back. But I mean, that's a story for another day. But the point was, I think the same goes with the Falklands. The UK used to say, right, this is the mission that we need to do. Therefore, what we've got is not perfect. And we've got to do something about it. And therefore, maybe there were urgent operational requirements and they made it fit for that job as much as they could. So, today, I don't think, because the ship is so big, the aircraft are so expensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we have governments at the moment, or we have had governments in recent years that are prepared to take a risk like that, are prepared to spend a little bit over a short term to get something ready for that. I don't think they're there. And that's what I think outsiders probably don't understand, is how lacking in real commitment to that kind of mission with risk British governments and the current government, by the look of it, are. They just don't want to do it. And because they're afraid of a PR disaster, I guess. I mean, that's what's going on. Sad to say.
One of the things I put, when we talk about the atrophy and the cutting, one of the options that should be put forward, that should be discussed, is we've got two aircraft carriers. Guess what? We can really only really afford one from an air group point of view. So only have one. The French manage perfectly well with one. So you've got to start asking these difficult questions. Can the Royal Navy, can the UK, does the UK really need two aircraft carriers? Oh, we need two because we need availability and we need this and we need that. And when Charles de Gaulle goes into refit, it's in refit for 2 years. Okay. Does France go down the league table in the 2 years that their aircraft carrier is in refit? It doesn't. So those are the type of difficult questions that we should be asking ourselves. Would it be better to sell one of the aircraft carriers to Australia? So you sell it to Australia. We were going to do that with Invincible in 1981. You sell it to Australia because the Australians then pick up the cost. They already fly the F-35A, so they can fly the F-35B, which means that they can share with us. So within the AUKUS construct, that would work. And now suddenly we've got an aircraft carrier in a region where it might actually be needed and where the US can say, oh, we can now use that because it's an active platform that we can use because the Australians have put their equipment on it, their people on it, and we can deploy it. So you've got two aircraft carriers being deployed at the same time, one in the Northern Hemisphere by the Brits, one in the Southern Hemisphere by the Australians. I think these are going back to all the points I made at the beginning, these are the questions that should be being asked. And when it comes to that courageous minister or that courageous First Sea Lord or that courageous Chief of Defence Staff, when he or she is looking at the number of assets available against the strategy that needs to be delivered, sometimes you've got to be able to say, do you know what? We can't afford six 45s. We can only afford, we haven't even got on to the Type 83 debate, which is, again, for another day.
It is.
I've already seen the models of people putting 116 SM3 or SM6 missiles or 192 missiles and missile barges. An SM3 missile is $3 million. An SM6 missile is $8 to $16 million. When you start looking at that cost, multiply that by 96 or 116, we'll have one. That's it, because that's all the UK can afford. But you've got all of these... I'm not going to call them fantasists, it's rude, but you've got all of these people out there now designing future fleets of missile barges and all.
Who are these people?
Who are these people? And where's the money,
Yeah. I mean, I think we should wrap it up now, Lee. And I think, I mean, not because you haven't been fascinating with all your prognostications, whatever you want to call them, like Nostradamus. No, not because of that, but because basically I think your point there about, and to use the pun again, daring decisions is a very good one to end on because, you are contributing to it. And my next job after the next edition of this magazine is to do our next guide to the Royal Navy. And of course, we will look at the positive side and of course, we'll accentuate all of that kind of stuff. But we'll also deliver in the guide to the Royal Navy, 12th edition, we'll deliver some kind of realistic hard truths. And you're going to have a piece in there and other people are going to have a piece in there. And for now, for the next fleet list, because we started on the 2006 fleet list, which is now, 20 years ago, 20 years on, the next Guide to the Royal Navy will have HMS Daring in there. We'll have two carriers And we'll have, well, six attack submarines for now. But, we, you know, I do wonder what the next one after that will be, you know, in 2 years' time. So anyway, thanks for coming on and having this chat.
No worries.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. We've put it over two episodes because it deserves it.
Yeah, so sorry for rambling. Yeah, I do ramble on.
Brilliant, brilliant. Great stuff.
Thank you for listening to Warships Pod, and I must say it's been a very busy time in the bunker where we produce the magazine, because we've had to turn out not only the latest edition of the Guide to the Royal Navy, which is out on, as mentioned a few moments ago, out on the 18th of September, but also another magazine almost at the same time going to press, which is the October edition, which is out on September the 19th, the day after the Guide to the Royal Navy is unleashed. In the October edition, we look at a recent incident in northern seas where a suspected Russian submarine was pursued by NATO aircraft and probably surface warships as well. We look at also the US Navy and its continuing efforts to create drone fleets, and the fact that Norway has chosen the British Type 26 frigate for its future anti-submarine vessel. Oh, and one thing that is certainly worth reading is Robert Farley's article on the World War II invasion that never happened, and that was the invasion of Japan in 1945 that was postponed forever because of the dropping of the atom bombs. And anyway, that's all coming up. That's on the menu, and I hope it's a satisfying meal for you all, and look forward to chatting with a guest in the near future, and thanks for being piped aboard the Warships Pod.